Afterward. Since Ordinary Men first appeared 6 years ago, it has been relentlessly scrutinized and criticized by another author, Daniel Jonah Goldhagen, who not only wrote on the same topic, the motivation of the ordinary Germans who became Holocaust perpetrators, but also chose to develop his own work in part by researching the same documents concerning the same unit of Holocaust killers, namely the post-war judicial interrogations of members of Reserve Police Battalion 101. It is not unusual, of course, for different scholars to ask different questions of, apply different methodologies to, and derive different interpretations from the same sources. But the differences are seldom so stridently argued and cast in such an adversarial framework as in this case. And seldom in academic controversies has the work of one of the adversaries become both an international bestseller and the subject of countless reviews, ranging from the euphorically positive to harshly negative. Professor Goldhagen, so critical of my work, has become a target in turn. In short, Goldhagen's critique of this book and the subsequent controversy surrounding his own work merit a retrospective afterward in subsequent editions of Ordinary Men. On several issues, Goldhagen and I do not disagree. First, the participation of numerous ordinary Germans in the mass murder of Jews, and second, the high degree of voluntarism they exhibited. The bulk of the killers were not specially selected, but drawn at random from a cross-section of German society. And they did not kill because they were coerced by the threat of dire punishment for refusing. However, neither of these conclusions is a new discovery in the field of Holocaust studies. It was one of the fundamental conclusions of Raoul Hilberg's magisterial and path-breaking study, The Destruction of the European Jews, which first appeared in 1961, that the perpetrators were not different in their moral makeup from the rest of the population. The German perpetrator was not a special kind of German. The perpetrators represented a remarkable cross-section of the German population, and the machinery of destruction was structurally no different from organized German society as a whole. And it was the German scholar Herbert Jaeger and the German prosecutors of the 1960s who firmly established that no one could document a single case in which Germans who refused to carry out the killing of unarmed civilians suffered dire consequences. Goldhagen does credit Jaeger and the German prosecutors in this regard, but he is utterly dismissive of Hilberg. Aside from the differences in the tone that we employ in writing about the Holocaust, and in the attitude that we display toward other scholars who have worked in this field of study, Goldhagen and I disagree significantly in two major areas of historical interpretation. The first is our different assessments of the role of anti-Semitism in German history, including the National Socialist era. The second is our different assessments of the motivations of the ordinary German men who became Holocaust killers. These are the two topics that I would like to discuss at some length. In his book, Hitler's Willing Executioners, Daniel Goldhagen asserts that anti-Semitism more or less governed the ideational life of civil society in pre-Nazi Germany. And when the Germans elected Hitler to power, the centrality of anti-Semitism in the party's worldview, program, and rhetoric mirrored the sentiments of German culture. Because Hitler and the Germans were of one mind about the Jews, he had merely to unshackle or unleash their pre-existing, pent-up anti-Semitism to perpetrate the Holocaust. To buttress his view that the Nazi regime should be seen merely as allowing or encouraging Germans to do what they wanted to do all along, and not basically shaping German attitudes and behavior after 1933, Goldhagen formulates a thesis that he proclaims is new to the study of anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism does not appear, disappear, then reappear in a given society. Always present, anti-Semitism becomes more or less manifest. Not anti-Semitism itself, but merely its expression, either increases or decreases according to changing conditions. Then, in Goldhagen's account, this picture of underlying permanency and superficial fluctuation changes abruptly after 1945. The pervasive and permanent eliminationist German anti-Semitism that was the sole and sufficient motivation of the Holocaust killers suddenly disappeared. Given re-education, a change in public conversation, a law banning anti-Semitic expression, and the lack of institutional reinforcement, a German culture dominated by anti-Semitism for centuries was suddenly transformed. Now we are told the Germans are just like us. That anti-Semitism was a very significant aspect of Germany's political culture before 1945, and that Germany's political culture is both profoundly different and dramatically less anti-Semitic today, are two propositions that I can easily support. But if Germany's political culture in general, and anti-Semitism in particular, could be transformed after 1945 by changes in education, public conversation, law, and institutional reinforcements, as Goldhagen suggests, then it seems to me equally plausible that they could have been equally transformed in the three or four decades preceding 1945, and especially during the 12 years of Nazi rule. In his introductory chapter, Goldhagen provides a useful model for a three-dimensional analysis of anti-Semitism, even if he does not employ his own model in the subsequent chapters. Anti-Semitism, he argues, varies according to the alleged source or cause, for example, race, religion, culture, or environment, of the Jew's alleged negative character. It varies in degree of preoccupation or priority, or how important is anti-Semitism to the anti-Semite. And it varies in degree of threat, or how endangered the anti-Semite feels. That anti-Semitism can vary in its diagnosis of the alleged Jewish threat and along continuums of priority and intensity would suggest not only that anti-Semitism changes over time, as any or all of these dimensions change, but that it can exist in infinite variety. Even for a single country like Germany, I think we should speak and think in the plural of anti-Semitisms rather than anti-Semitism. The actual concept Goldhagen employs, however, produces the opposite effect. It erases all differentiation and subsumes all manifestations of anti-Semitism in Germany under a single rubric. All Germans who perceived Jews as different and viewed this difference as something negative that should disappear, whether through conversion, assimilation, emigration, or extermination, are classed as eliminationist anti-Semites, even if by Goldhagen's prior model they differ as to cause, priority, and intensity. Such differences that do exist are analytically insignificant in any case, for according to Goldhagen, variations on eliminationist solutions tend to metastasize into extermination. By using such an approach, Goldhagen moves seamlessly from a variety of anti-Semitic manifestations in Germany to a single German eliminationist anti-Semitism that, taking on the properties of organic malignancy, naturally metastasized into extermination. Thus, all Germany was of one mind with Hitler on the justice and necessity of the final solution. If one adopts the analytical model that Goldhagen proposes, rather than the concept he actually uses, what then can one say about the changing variety of anti-Semitisms in German political culture and their role in the Holocaust, and where to begin? Let us begin with 19th century German history, or more precisely, with various interpretations of Germany's alleged special path or Sonderweg. According to the traditional social structural approach, Germany's failed liberal revolution of 1848 derailed simultaneous political and economic modernization. Thereafter, the pre-capitalist German elites maintained their privileges in an autocratic political system, while the unnerved middle classes were bought off with the prosperity of rapid economic modernization, gratified by a national unification they had been unable to achieve through their own revolutionary efforts, and ultimately manipulated by an escalating social imperialism. According to the cultural ideological approach, the distorted and incomplete embrace of the Enlightenment by some German intellectuals, followed by their despair over an increasingly endangered and dissolving traditional world, led to a continuing rejection of liberal democratic values and traditions on the one hand, and a selective reconciliation with aspects of modernity, such as modern technology and ends-means rationality, on the other, producing what Geoffrey Herff termed a peculiarly German reactionary modernism. A third approach, exemplified by John Weiss and Daniel Goldhagen, asserts a German Sonderweg in terms of the singular breadth and virulence of anti-Semitism in Germany, though the former paints with a less broad brush than the latter, and is careful to identify the late 19th century loci of this German anti-Semitism in populist political movements and among the political and academic elites. It seems to me that Shulamit Volkov's interpretation of late 19th century German anti-Semitism as a cultural code constitutes an admirable synthesis of major elements of these different, though not totally mutually exclusive, notions of a German Sonderweg. German conservatives, dominating an illiberal political system, but feeling their leading role increasingly imperiled by the changes unleashed by modernization, associated anti-Semitism with everything they felt threatened by: liberalism, democracy, socialism, internationalism, capitalism, and cultural experimentation. To be a self-proclaimed anti-Semite was also to be authoritarian, nationalist, imperialist, protectionist, corporative, and culturally traditional. Volkov concludes, "Anti-Semitism was by then strongly associated with everything the conservatives stood for. It became increasingly inseparable from their anti-modernism." But insofar as the conservatives co-opted the anti-Semitic issue from populist, single-issue anti-Semitic political parties and enlisted pseudoscientific and social Darwinist racial thinking in its support, the conservatives were embracing an issue in defense of reaction that had a peculiarly modern cast to it, not unlike the simultaneous embrace of naval building. By the turn of the century, a German anti-Semitism increasingly racial in nature had become an integral part of the conservative political platform and penetrated deeply into the universities. It had become more politicized and institutionalized than in the Western democracies of France, Britain, and the United States. But this does not mean that late 19th century German anti-Semitism dominated either politics or ideational life. The conservatives and single-issue anti-Semitic parties together constituted a minority. While majorities could be found in the Prussian Landtag to pass discriminatory legislation against Catholics in the 1870s and in the Reichstag against socialists in the 1880s, the emancipation of Germany's Jews, who constituted less than 1% of the population and were scarcely capable of defending themselves against a Germany united in hostile obsession against them, was not revoked. If the left did not exhibit a philo-Semitism comparable to the right's anti-Semitism, it was primarily because for the left, anti-Semitism was a non-issue that did not fit into its own class analysis, not because of its own anti-Semitism. Even for the openly anti-Semitic conservatives, the Jewish issue was but one among many, and to suggest that they felt more threatened by the Jews than, for example, by the Triple Entente abroad or social democracy at home would be a serious distortion. If anti-Semitism was neither the priority issue nor the greatest threat, even for conservatives, how much less was this the case for the rest of German society? As Richard Levy has noted, one can make a convincing case that Jews were of very little interest to most Germans most of the time. Putting them at the center of German history in the 19th and 20th centuries is a highly unproductive strategy. For some Germans, of course, Jews were the top priority and source of greatest fear. The turn-of-the-century anti-Semitism of German conservatives fits well Gavin Langmuir's notion of xenophobic anti-Semitism, a negative stereotype comprised of various assertions that did not describe the real Jewish minority, but rather symbolized various threats and menaces that anti-Semites could not and did not want to understand. Langmuir notes as well that xenophobic anti-Semitism provides the fertile soil for the growth of fantastic or chimeric anti-Semitism, or what Saul Friedlander has recently dubbed redemptive anti-Semitism. If Germany's xenophobic anti-Semitism was an important piece of the political platform of an important segment of the political spectrum, the redemptive anti-Semites, with their chimeric accusations, from Jewish poisoning of Aryan blood to a secret Jewish world conspiracy behind the twin threats of Marxist revolution and plutocratic democracy, were still a fringe phenomenon. The succession of traumatic experiences in Germany between 1912 and 1929, loss of control of the Reichstag by the right, military defeat, revolution, runaway inflation, and economic collapse, transformed German politics. The right grew at the expense of the center, and within the former, the radicals or new right grew at the expense of the traditionalists or old right. Chimeric anti-Semitism grew commensurately from a fringe phenomenon to the core idea of a movement that became Germany's largest political party in the summer of 1932 and its ruling party 6 months later. That fact alone makes the history of Germany and German anti-Semitism different from that of any other country in Europe. But even this must be kept in perspective. The Nazis never gained more than 37% of the vote in a free election, less than the combined socialist-communist vote. Daniel Goldhagen is right to remind us that individuals' attitudes on single issues cannot be inferred from their votes. But it is highly unlikely that he is correct in his related assertion that large numbers of Germans who voted for the Social Democratic Party for economic reasons were nonetheless of one mind with Hitler and the Nazis about Jews. While I cannot prove it, I strongly suspect far more Germans voted Nazi for reasons other than anti-Semitism than Germans who considered anti-Semitism a priority issue but nonetheless voted for a party other than the Nazis. Neither the election returns nor any plausible spin put on them suggest that in 1932, the vast majority of Germans were of one mind with Hitler about the Jews, or that the centrality of anti-Semitism in the party's worldview, program, and rhetoric mirrored the sentiments of German culture. Beginning in 1933, all the factors that Goldhagen credits with dismantling German anti-Semitism after 1945, education, public conversation, law, and institutional reinforcement, were operating in the opposite direction, to intensify anti-Semitism among the Germans, and indeed in a far more concerted manner than in the post-war period. Can one seriously doubt that this had significant impact, particularly given the rising popularity of Hitler and the regime for its economic and foreign policy successes? As William Sheridan Allen succinctly concluded, even in a highly Nazified town like Northheim, most people were drawn to anti-Semitism because they were drawn to Nazism, not the other way around. Moreover, the 1936 Sopade Underground report, to which Goldhagen repeatedly refers, anti-Semitism has no doubt taken root in white circles of the population. The general anti-Semitic psychosis affects even thoughtful people, our comrades as well, is evidence of change in German attitudes following the Nazi seizure of power in 1933, not the prior situation. Even in the post-1933 period, however, it is best to speak in the plural of German anti-Semitisms. Within the party, there was indeed a large core of Germans for whom the Jews were a dire racial threat and central priority. The hardcore chimeric or redemptive anti-Semites of the Nazi movement differed in style and preferred response, however. At one end of the spectrum were the SA and Streiker types, lusting for pogroms. At the other end were the cool and calculating intellectual anti-Semites described by Ulrich Herbert in his new biography of Werner Best, who advocated a more systematic but dispassionate persecution. Hitler's conservative allies favored de-emancipation and segregation of the Jews as part of the counter-revolution and movement of national renewal. They strove to end the allegedly inordinate Jewish influence on German life, though this was scarcely a priority equal to dismantling the labor unions, Marxist parties, and parliamentary democracy, or to rearmament and the restoration of Germany's great power status. They often spoke the language of racial anti-Semitism, but not consistently. Some, like President Hindenburg, wanted exemptions for Jews who had proved themselves worthy through loyal service to the fatherland, and the churches, of course, wanted exemptions for converted Jews. In my opinion, it is unlikely that the conservatives on their own would have proceeded beyond the initial discriminatory measures of 1933-34 that drove the Jews out of the civil and military services, the professions, and cultural life. What the conservatives conceived of as sufficient measures overlapped with what were for the Nazis scarcely the first steps. The Nazis understood far better than the conservatives the distance that separated them. As complicitous in the first anti-Jewish measures as they were in the wrecking of democracy, however, the conservatives could no more oppose radicalization of the persecution of the Jews than they could demand for themselves rights under the dictatorship that they had denied others. And while they may have lamented their own increasing loss of privilege and power at the hands of the Nazis whom they helped into power, with few exceptions, they had no remorse or regret for the fate of the Jews. To argue that the Nazis' conservative allies were not of one mind with Hitler does not deny that their behavior was despicable and their responsibility considerable. As before, xenophobic anti-Semitism provided fertile soil for the chimeric anti-Semites. What can be said of the German population at large in the 1930s? Was the bulk of the German population swept along by the Nazis' anti-Semitic tide? Only in part, according to the detailed research of historians like Ian Kershaw, Otto Dovkulka, and David Bankier, who have reached a surprising degree of consensus on this issue. For the 1933-39 period, these three historians distinguish between a minority of party activists, for whom anti-Semitism was an urgent priority, and the bulk of the German population, for whom it was not. Apart from the activists, the vast majority of the general population did not clamor or press for anti-Semitic measures. But the majority of ordinary Germans, whom Saul Friedlander describes as onlookers in contrast to activists, nonetheless accepted the legal measures of the regime, which ended emancipation and drove the Jews from public positions in 1933, socially ostracized the Jews in 1935, and completed the expropriation of their property in 1938-39. Yet this majority was critical of the hooliganistic violence of party radicals toward the same German Jews whose legal persecution they approved. The boycott of 1933, the vandalistic outbreaks of 1935, and above all the Kristallnacht pogrom of November 1938, produced a negative response among much of the German population. Most important, however, a gulf had opened up between the Jewish minority and the general population. The latter, while not mobilized around strident and violent anti-Semitism, were increasingly apathetic, passive, and indifferent to the fate of the former. Anti-Semitic measures, if carried out in an orderly and legal manner, were widely accepted for two reasons. Such measures sustained the hope of curbing the violence most Germans found so distasteful, and most Germans now accepted the goal of limiting and even ending the role of Jews in German society. This was a major accomplishment for the regime, but it still did not offer the prospect that most ordinary Germans would approve of, much less participate in. The mass murder of European Jewry, that the onlookers of 1938 would become the genocidal killers of 1941-42. Concerning the war years, Kershaw, Kulka, and Bankier disagree on some issues, but generally concur that the anti-Semitism of the true believers was not identical to the anti-Semitic attitudes of the general population, and that the anti-Semitic priorities and genocidal commitment of the regime were still not shared by ordinary Germans. Bankier, who in no way downplays German anti-Semitism, wrote, "Ordinary Germans knew how to distinguish between an acceptable discrimination and the unacceptable horror of genocide. The more the news of mass murder filtered through, the less the public wanted to be involved in the final solution of the Jewish question. Nonetheless, as Kulka put it, a strikingly abysmal indifference to the fate of the Jews as human beings gave the regime the freedom of action to push for a radical final solution." Kershaw emphasized the same point with his memorable phrase that the road to Auschwitz was built by hatred, but paved with indifference. Kulka and Rodriguez are uneasy about the term indifference, which they as well as Kershaw use, feeling that it does not sufficiently capture the internalization of Nazi anti-Semitism among the population at large, particularly concerning the acceptance of a solution to the Jewish question through some unspecified kind of elimination. They suggest a more morally weighted term, such as passive complicity or objective complicity. Goldhagen is more emphatic, declaring the very concept of indifference, which he equates with having no views on and being utterly morally neutral to mass slaughter, to be conceptually flawed and psychologically impossible. For Goldhagen, Germans were not apathetic and indifferent, but pitiless, unsympathetic, and callous, and their silence should be interpreted as approval. I have no problem with the desire of Kulka, Rodriguez, and Goldhagen to employ more powerful, morally condemnatory language to describe German behavior. But I do not think the choice of language here alters the basic point made by Kershaw, Kulka, and Bankier, namely that in terms of the priority of anti-Semitism and commitment to killing Jews, a useful and important distinction can be made between the Nazi core and the population at large. In my opinion, Goldhagen is setting up a straw man in his definition of indifference and misinterprets the meaning of silence under a dictatorship. He also seems oblivious to the fact that Kershaw's notion of indifference anticipates the continuums in Goldhagen's own analytical model. When Kershaw notes that during the war years, Germans may well have disliked Jews more while caring about them less. There are two additional points on which Goldhagen and I agree. First, one must look at the attitudes and behavior of ordinary Germans, not only on the home front, but also in occupied Eastern Europe. And second, when faced with the task of killing Jews, most ordinary Germans there became willing executioners. If ordinary Germans at home were indifferent and apathetic, complicitous and callous, in the East they were killers. We differ, however, on context and motive for this murderous behavior. For Goldhagen, these ordinary Germans, equipped with little more than the cultural notions current in Germany before 1933, and now at last given the opportunity, simply wanted to be genocidal executioners. In my opinion, ordinary Germans in Eastern Europe brought with them a set of attitudes that included not only the different strands of anti-Semitism found in German society and fanned by the regime since 1933, but much else as well. As the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, the Freikorps campaigns, and the almost universal rejection of the Versailles Treaty demonstrate, refusal to accept the verdict of World War I, imperial aspirations in Eastern Europe underpinned by notions of German racial superiority, and virulent anti-communism were broadly held sentiments in German society. I would argue that they provided more common ground for the bulk of the German population and the Nazis than did anti-Semitism. And in Eastern Europe, ordinary Germans were transformed even more by the events and situation of 1939-41 than they had been by their experience of the domestic dictatorship of 1933-39. Germany was now at war. Moreover, this was a race war of imperial conquest. These ordinary Germans were stationed in the territory where the native populations were proclaimed inferior and occupying Germans were constantly exhorted to behave as the master race. And the Jews encountered in these territories were the strange and alien Ostjuden, not assimilated middle-class German Jews. In 1941, two more major factors, the ideological crusade against Bolshevism and war of destruction, were added. Is it even plausible to suggest that this wartime change in situation and context did not alter the attitudes and behavior of ordinary Germans in Eastern Europe, and that only a common cognitive image of Jews predating 1933 and held by virtually all Germans accounts for their willingness, and for some even eagerness, to kill Jews? In this regard, it is important to note that before the final solution was implemented, beginning on Soviet territory in the second half of 1941 and in Poland and the rest of Europe in the spring of 1942, the Nazi regime had already found willing executioners for 70,000 to 80,000 mentally and physically handicapped Germans, tens of thousands of Polish intelligentsia, tens of thousands of non-combatant victims of reprisal shootings, and more than 2 million Russian POWs. Clearly, as of September 1939, the regime was increasingly capable of legitimizing and organizing mass murder on a staggering scale that did not depend on the anti-Semitic motivation of the perpetrators and the Jewish identity of the victims. Daniel Goldhagen has recently written that even if he is not entirely correct about the scope and character of German anti-Semitism, it does not follow that this would invalidate his conclusions about the perpetrators and their motives. Central to Goldhagen's interpretation is that these men were not only willing executioners, but in fact wanted to be genocidal executioners of Jews. They slaked their Jewish bloodlust with gusto. They had fun. They killed for pleasure. Moreover, the quantity and quality of personalized brutality and cruelty that the Germans perpetrated upon Jews was also distinctive and unprecedented. Indeed, they stand out in the long annals of human barbarism. Goldhagen concludes emphatically that with regard to the motivational cause of the Holocaust, for the vast majority of the perpetrators, a monocausal explanation does suffice, namely the demonological anti-Semitism that was the common structure of the perpetrators' cognition and of German society in general. In support of this interpretation, Goldhagen constantly invokes the conscious use of rigorous social science methodology as one of the factors that sets his book above the work and beyond the reproach of other scholars in the field. I would like to focus on two aspects of Goldhagen's argument for this interpretation and measure them against the very standard of rigorous social science that he himself sets. First, the design and structure of his argument, and second, his methodology concerning use of evidence. While the bulk of Goldhagen's book focuses on anti-Semitism in German history and German treatment of Jews during the Holocaust, crucial to the design of his argument are two comparisons. First, Germans are compared with non-Germans in their respective treatment of Jews. Second, German treatment of Jewish victims is compared with their treatment of non-Jewish victims. The purpose is to establish that only a pervasive, eliminationist anti-Semitism specific to German society can account for the stark differences that allegedly emerge from these comparisons. The problems with the design are manifold. For the second comparison to adequately support his argument, Goldhagen must prove not only that Germans treated Jewish and non-Jewish victims differently, on which virtually all historians agree, but also that the different treatment is to be explained fundamentally by the anti-Semitic motivation of the vast majority of the perpetrators, and not by other possible motivations, such as compliance with different government policies for different victim groups. The second and third case studies of Hitler's willing executioners are aimed at meeting the burden of proof on these two points. Goldhagen argues that the case of the Lipowa and Flughaven Jewish labor camps in Lublin demonstrates that in contrast to other victims, only Jewish labor was treated murderously by the Germans without regard for, and indeed even counter to, economic rationality. And the Helmbrecht's death march case, he argues, demonstrates that Jews were killed even when orders have been given to keep them alive. And hence the driving motive for the killing was not compliance to government policy or obedience to orders, but the deep personal hatred of the perpetrators for their Jewish victims that had been inculcated by German culture. And from all his cases, Goldhagen argues that the unprecedented, continuous, and pervasive cruelty with which the German perpetrators treated their Jewish victims is only explicable for the same reason. Bringing wider attention to the death marches is one of the redeeming merits of Goldhagen's book, but his attempt to generalize from the one case of the Helmbrecht's death march is unpersuasive. His powerful description of this horrific event must not obscure the fact that in terms of proof of a widespread eagerness to kill Jews, even contrary to orders, he has established neither its representativeness for other death marches, nor that the same phenomenon did not occur in Germans' treatment of other victims. And even in his own case, Goldhagen admits that the guards had to prevent the local German population from providing food and lodging, and German soldiers from providing medical care to the Jews, without ever considering whether these other Germans were not just as typical of German society at large as the murderous death march guards. Indeed, The stark difference in behavior of these different groups of Germans would suggest the importance of situational and institutional factors that he dismisses. Likewise, one can find a counterexample concerning the ongoing killing of non-Jewish victims despite a top-level change of policy and the irrational misuse of non-Jewish labor. Having just decided to murder all the Jews of Europe, in October 1941, the Nazi regime reversed its earlier position concerning Soviet prisoners of war and ordered that henceforth they were to be used for labor rather than simply left to die from hunger, disease, and exposure. Rudolf Höss at Auschwitz was informed that he would receive a large contingent of Soviet POWs for the purpose of constructing a new camp at Birkenau, a project high on Himmler's list of priorities. In short, both economic rationale and superior orders mandated that the Soviet POWs be kept alive and put to useful labor. Nearly 10,000 Soviet POWs arrived in Auschwitz in October 1941 and were sent to Birkenau. By the end of February, 4 months later, only 945 were alive, a survival rate of 9.5%. Himmler's order to use Soviet POWs for a priority construction project did not immediately reverse either the habitual and ingrained behavior of concentration camp personnel of using labor for torture and extermination, or the deadly conditions at Birkenau. Indeed, as Michael Thad Allen has pointed out in his recent PhD dissertation on the Business Administration main office, Wirtschaftsverwaltungshauptamt of the SS, within the concentration camp system, the use of labor to punish and torture inmates rather than for production was part of the institutional culture long before Jews were a significant portion of the inmate population. Moreover, attempts to harness concentration camp labor productively continued to founder throughout the war on the resistance of concentration camp personnel stubbornly hostile to economic rationality. The concentration camp culture proved difficult to alter in this regard, whatever the ethnic identity of the prisoners involved. What about the treatment of Jewish labor in Birkenau at this time? In comparison, 7,000 young Slovak Jewish women were sent to the Auschwitz main camp, or Stammlager, in the spring of 1942, also for labor. In mid-August, the 6,000 who were still alive were moved to Birkenau. At the end of December, just over 4 months later, only 650 had not yet died, a comparable survival rate of 10.8%. In short, institutional and situational factors and an ideology whose murderous potential was not derived solely from anti-Semitism produced nearly identical fatality rates among the Soviet POWs and Slovak Jewish women over the same period of time in the same camp, and this despite a change in government policy concerning the fate of Soviet POWs and the urgency of the economic task they were to perform. Goldhagen is indeed correct that in the long run the murderous treatment of Soviet POWs did change, while the murderous treatment of Jewish labor, except in minor ways, did not. But this simply indicates that despite institutional inertia and the initial persistence of murderous patterns of behavior towards Soviet POWs, compliance with government policy ultimately prevailed in both cases. It does not demonstrate, as Goldhagen suggests, that the fate of Slavs, such as the Soviet POWs, and Jews differed primarily because of different culturally induced attitudes toward the two sets of victims. The Germans presided over the death of some 2 million Soviet POWs in the first 9 months of the war, far more than the number of Jewish victims up to that point. The death rate in these POW camps far exceeded the death rates in the Polish ghettos prior to the final solution. The fact that the Nazi regime changed its policy to murder all Jews and changed its policy not to starve all Soviet POWs is more a measure of the ideology, priorities, and obsessions of Hitler and the Nazi leadership than of the attitudes of German society. The staggering fatality rate of Soviet POWs in the first months suggests, above all, the regime's capacity to harness ordinary Germans to murder limitless numbers of Soviet POWs if that had remained its goal. The continuing mass death of Soviet POWs into the spring of 1942 demonstrates that killing institutions are not turned off and the attitudes and behavior of their personnel are not altered instantly, even when policy changes. There are, in short, a number of conceivable variables: government policy and past patterns of behavior, as well as culturally induced cognitive images, that are important. Yet, in accounting for differential German behavior toward Jewish and non-Jewish victims, Goldhagen's argument does not adequately separate the variety of possible causal factors. His insistence on the German cognitive image of Jews as the only adequate framework is bolstered above all by his emphasis on the cruelty of the perpetrators. However, the argument from unprecedented singular German cruelty toward Jews is problematic on two counts. First, Goldhagen's claim of singularity is grounded on the emotional impact of his narrative rather than actual comparison. He offers numerous graphic and chilling descriptions of German cruelty toward Jews, and then simply asserts to the numbed and horrified reader that such behavior is clearly unprecedented. If only that were the case. Unfortunately, accounts of Romanian and Croatian killings would readily demonstrate that these collaborators not only equaled, but routinely surpassed the Germans in cruelty. And that leaves myriad possible non-Holocaust examples from Cambodia to Rwanda totally aside. Conversely, he downplays the cruelty in the Nazi murder of other victims, particularly the German handicapped, in which Germans allegedly were coldly involved in inflicting painless death without celebration. Yet the mentally handicapped were first gunned down by the firing squads of the Eichmann Commando before the development of the gas vans and gas chambers, and many infants were simply not fed and left to starve to death. Screaming and fleeing patients were hunted down and dragged away from asylums to the waiting buses. And at Hadamar, the killers threw a party to celebrate the milestone of 10,000 victims. Secondly, Goldhagen simply asserts as intuitively self-evident that such cruelty can be explained only by a cognitive image of the Jew peculiar to German culture. Goldhagen is quite correct that cruelty in the Holocaust, so salient in the memories of survivors, is an issue that scholars have not dealt with at length, but that does not mean his own ungrounded assertion concerning motivation is correct. Interestingly, the eloquent survivor Primo Levi agreed at least in part with Franz Stangl, the notorious Treblinka commandant, on a different, quite functional explanation for perpetrator cruelty, namely that the total debasement and humiliation of the victim facilitated the victim's dehumanization so essential to the actions of the perpetrator. To condition those who actually had to carry out the policies, to make it possible for them to do what they did. But we can share Levy's frustration that such an explanation in itself, if not entirely wrong, is nonetheless inadequate. This is an explanation not devoid of logic, he continues, but it shouts to heaven. It is the sole usefulness of useless violence. Indeed, too many instances of cruelty transcend a purely functional explanation. Another approach is taken by Fred E. Katz, who argues that in a killing environment, the creation of a culture of cruelty is a powerful phenomenon that provides many satisfactions: individualized reputation and enhanced standing among one's peers, alleviation of boredom, and a sense of joy and festivity, of artistry and creativity to those who flaunt their gratuitous and inventive cruelties. But we are still left with an unresolved question that cannot be solved by simple assertion. Is a culture of hatred the necessary precondition for such a culture of cruelty? Goldhagen has posed an important question. I do not believe that we have as yet found a satisfactory answer. Let us turn to the other comparison, namely that of German and non-German treatment of Jews. To be valid by accepted social science standards, German behavior would have to be compared with behavior in the complete set, or at least an unbiased random sample, of countries involved in the final solution. Instead, Goldhagen suggests the behavior of Danes and Italians as the standard of comparison, which is neither random nor unbiased. Indeed, his suggestion merely begs the question of the rarity of Danish and Italian behavior vis-à-vis the ability of the Germans to find murderous collaborators virtually everywhere else in Europe. It does not demonstrate the singularity of German treatment of Jews, much less that this was due to a culturally specific German antisemitism. Elsewhere, Goldhagen acknowledges the participation of East Europeans in the killing squads and calls for a study of the combination of cognitive and situational factors that brought such perpetrators to the Holocaust. He does not explain why a multi-causal explanation is suddenly acceptable for East European but not for German perpetrators. Moreover, as I noted at the April 1996 symposium at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, the example of the Luxembourgers in Reserve Police Battalion 101 offers the rare opportunity of comparing people in the same situation but of different cultural background. While the evidence is suggestive rather than conclusive, I noted that the 14 Luxembourgers seemed to have behaved very much like their German comrades, implying that situational factors were very strong indeed. Goldhagen replied that the 14 Luxembourgers were only a small number from which one could not draw sweeping conclusions, though he has not been reluctant to draw sweeping conclusions from the small numbers of guards in the Lipowa and Flughafen labor camps or on the Helmbrecht's death march. My objections to the design of Goldhagen's argument do not disprove his interpretation as such. They merely demonstrate that he has not met the standard of proof of rigorous social science that he has not only set for himself, but also repeatedly claimed that others have so ignominiously failed even to understand. To demonstrate not only the lack of conclusive proof on behalf of his interpretation, but flaws that render it unpersuasive, we must examine his use of evidence. Goldhagen admits that he began with the hypothesis that the perpetrators were motivated to take part in the lethal persecution of the Jews because of their beliefs about the victims. The primary source of evidence for the behavior and motivation of the men of Reserve Police Battalion 101 by which to measure this hypothesis is the post-war testimony gathered through judicial investigation. It is not a matter of contention among scholars that post-war perpetrator testimony is highly problematic. It is shaped both by the questions posed by the investigators and by the forgetfulness, repression, distortion, evasion, and mendacity of the witnesses. It is my position, however, that the judicial testimonies of Reserve Police Battalion 101 are qualitatively different from the vast bulk of such testimony. The roster of the unit survived, and more than 40% of the battalion members, most of them rank-and-file reservists rather than officers, were interrogated by able and persistent investigative attorneys. The large amount of unusually vivid and detailed testimony stands in stark contrast to the formulaic and transparently dishonest testimony so often encountered. Aware of the subjective and fallible nature of the judgments I will be making, I feel nonetheless that, used carefully, this body of testimony offers the historian a unique opportunity to probe issues in a way that is not possible from the records of other cases. It is no accident, after all, that among the hundreds of post-war German trials, both Goldhagen and I found our ways independently to the very same court records. To deal with the problem of the evidentiary value of perpetrator testimony, Goldhagen argues, in contrast, that the only methodological position that makes sense is to discount all self-exculpating testimony that finds no corroboration from other sources. Goldhagen is also aware that the temptation to pick and choose propitious material from a large number of cases should be resisted so as to avoid bias in the conclusions, and he asserts that in his methodology such bias is negligible. But does Goldhagen's methodology avoid bias? What, in practice, is Goldhagen's standard for judging testimony as self-exculpating and thus to be excluded unless corroborated? For Goldhagen, testimonies are in all likelihood self-exculpating if the witnesses deny giving their souls, their inner will, and moral assent to the killing. In short, testimony about any state of mind or motivation at odds with his initial hypothesis is excluded unless corroborated, and finding corroborating evidence concerning state of mind given the absence of contemporary letters and diaries, is nearly impossible. As a result, Goldhagen is left only with a residue of testimony compatible with his hypothesis, and the conclusions are, for all practical purposes, predetermined. A methodology that can scarcely do other than confirm the hypothesis that it was designed to test is not valid social science. The problem of a deterministic methodology is compounded by another flaw in Goldhagen's use of evidence, namely a double standard in which he does not apply the same evidentiary standards and high exclusionary threshold when the victims are Poles rather than Jews. The cumulative effect of these problems in Goldhagen's use of evidence can be dramatically illustrated in comparing our respective accounts of Reserve Police Battalion 101's initial massacres of Jews and Poles at Józefów and Talcin. According to Goldhagen, at Józefów, Major Wilhelm Trapp delivered a pep talk inciting his men to murder by activating the demonic view of the Jews that virtually all of them held. Though Trapp was conflicted and uneasy, his speech betrayed his Nazified conception of the Jews. Goldhagen concedes that many of the men were shaken, even momentarily depressed by the killings, but warns against the temptation of reading into the testimonies about the men's negative reaction more than visceral weakness when faced with too much blood and gore. What is left out of this portrayal? Goldhagen acknowledges in one footnote, though not in the main text, that one witness described Trapp as weeping. There is no mention of the other seven witnesses who described Trapp as weeping or otherwise displaying visible physical distress. He does not mention the testimony of two policemen who recalled that Trapp explicitly said the orders did not come from him, nor four of the five who noted that Trapp openly distanced himself from the orders when transmitting them to his men. He does not mention the testimony of Trapp's chauffeur concerning the events in Józefów. He later told me more or less, "If this Jewish business is ever avenged on earth, then have mercy on us Germans." The pep talk, allegedly activating a demonic view of the Jews, turns out on examination to be a rather pathetic attempt to rationalize the imminent massacre of Jews as a wartime action against Germany's enemies, similar to the bombs falling on German women and children at home. The repeated testimony of the men that they felt shaken, depressed, embittered, despondent, dejected, stricken, angered, and burdened is dismissed by Goldhagen out of hand as self-exculpatory or reflecting momentary visceral weakness. Describing the first execution of Poles in a reprisal shooting at Talcin, Goldhagen argues, "This illustrative episode juxtaposes the Germans' attitudes towards Poles and Jews." As proof, he cites just two witnesses, one witness to the effect that at Talcin Trapp wept, and another that some of the men expressed afterwards their desire not to undertake any more missions of this sort. In short, precisely the kinds of repeated testimony that Goldhagen excludes or dismisses when discussing the battalion's murder of Jews at Józefów is suddenly embraced, even when voiced by just two individuals, to prove how differently the battalion felt about murdering Poles. Moreover, this double standard in the selection of evidence can also be seen in Goldhagen's analysis of the men's motives. The failure of the policeman to opt out at Talcin is not construed as evidence of a desire to kill Poles, while not opting out at Józefów is cited as evidence that they wanted to be genocidal executioners of the Jews. Nothing more than momentary visceral weakness is seen in the mountain of testimony about the men's distress at Józefów, while the statement of a single witness at Talcin is cited as valid evidence of the men's obvious distaste and reluctance to kill Poles. The double standard concerning Jewish and Polish victims can be seen in yet another way. Goldhagen cites numerous instances of gratuitous and voluntaristic killing of Jews as relevant to assessing the attitudes of the killers, but he omits a similar case of gratuitous, voluntaristic killing by Reserve Police Battalion 101 when the victims were Poles. A German police official was reported killed in the village of Gniezdów, whereupon policemen about to visit the cinema in Opole were sent to carry out a reprisal action. Only elderly Poles, mostly women, remained in the village, as the younger Poles had all fled. Word came, moreover, that the ambushed German policemen had been only wounded, not killed. Nonetheless, the men of Reserve Police Battalion 101 shot all the elderly Poles and set the village on fire before returning to the cinema for an evening of casual and relaxing entertainment. There is not much evidence of obvious distaste and reluctance to kill Poles to be seen in this episode. Would Goldhagen have omitted this incident if the victims had been Jews, and an anti-Semitic motivation could have easily been inferred? A pattern of tendentious selection of evidence can also be seen in Goldhagen's portrayal of near-total uniformity among the men. Lieutenant Heinz Buchmann was the one member of the battalion who articulated a principled opposition to the mass murder and refused to take part in any aspect of the anti-Jewish actions. Concerning the difference in behavior between himself and the SS captains Julius Wohlauf and Wolfgang Hoffmann, Buchmann testified reluctantly that promotion was unimportant to him because he owned a successful business, while Wohlauf and Hoffmann were ambitious career policemen who wanted to become something. Moreover, he added, through my business experience, especially because it extended abroad, I had gained a better overview of things. Goldhagen quickly glosses over the importance Buchmann himself gives to careeristic motives and construes the second portion of the statement as evidence that Buchmann alone in the battalion was not in the grip of German hallucinatory anti-Semitism. But if Buchmann is to be cited as a prime witness providing evidence for a uniform anti-Semitism within the battalion, ought not the following statements also be included? Concerning the differing reactions of the men to Buchmann's own refusal to take part in the anti-Jewish actions, he said, "Among my subordinates, many understood my position, but others made disparaging remarks about me and looked down their noses at me." Concerning their attitude to the killing itself, he stated that the men did not carry out the Jewish actions with enthusiasm. The men were all very depressed. One final example of tendentious selectivity of evidence. Goldhagen consistently emphasizes that the perpetrators had fun killing Jews, and that these men's accounts of conversations that they had while in the killing field suggest that these men, in principle, approved of the genocide and of their own deeds. A typical example of this is his account of Sergeant Heinrich Beckemeyer's squad carrying out the Jew hunt in Womazi after the massacre. Goldhagen writes, "When Beckemeyer's men did find Jews, they not only killed them, but in one instance that has been described, they, or at least Beckemeyer, also had fun with them beforehand." He then quotes directly from the policeman's testimony. One episode has been preserved in my memory to this day. Under the command of Sergeant Beckemeyer, we had to convey a transport of Jews to some place. He had the Jews crawl through a waterhole and sing as they did it. When an old man could not walk anymore, which was when the crawling episode was finished, he shot him at close range in the mouth. At this point, Goldhagen breaks off the quote and resumes the description of the same incident from testimony given at a later interrogation. After Beckemeyer had shot the Jew, the latter raised his hand as if to appeal to God and then collapsed. The corpse of the Jew was simply left lying. We did not concern ourselves with it. How different this testimony sounds if the witness's account is not broken off. For after describing Beckemeyer's shooting of the old Jew in the mouth, he continues, "I said to Heinz Richter, who was walking next to me, 'I'd like to bump off this trash.' Indeed, according to the same witness, within the circle of comrades, Beckemeyer was deemed vile trash and a dirty dog. He was notorious for being violent and cruel to both Poles and Jews, and even for kicking his own men." In short, by tendentious selectivity, Goldhagen portrays this event as part of a pattern of generalized and uniform cruelty and approval, when the full testimony provides a picture instead of the cruelty of an especially vicious and disliked SS officer whose behavior evoked disapproval among his men. In contrast to Goldhagen, I offered a portrayal of the battalion that was multi-layered. Different groups within the battalion behaved in different ways. The eager killers, whose numbers increased over time, sought the opportunity to kill and celebrated their murderous deeds. The smallest group within the battalion comprised the non-shooters. With the exception of Lieutenant Buchmann, they did not make principled objections against the regime and its murderous policies. They did not reproach their comrades. They took advantage of Trapp's policy within the battalion of exempting from shooting those who didn't feel up to it by saying that they were too weak or that they had children. The largest group within the battalion did whatever they were asked to do without ever risking the onus of confronting authority or appearing weak. But they did not volunteer for or celebrate the killing. Increasingly numb and brutalized, they felt more pity for themselves because of the unpleasant work they had been assigned than they did for their dehumanized victims. For the most part, they did not think what they were doing was wrong or immoral because the killing was sanctioned by legitimate authority. Indeed, for the most part, they did not try to think, period. As one policeman stated, "Truthfully, I must say that at the time we didn't reflect about it at all. Only years later did any of us become truly conscious of what had happened then. Heavy drinking helped. Most of the other men drank so much solely because of the many shootings of Jews, for such a life was quite intolerable sober." That these men were willing executioners does not mean that they wanted to be genocidal executioners. This, in my opinion, is an important distinction that Goldhagen consistently blurs. He also repeatedly poses the interpretational dispute in the form of a false dichotomy. Either the German killers must have been of one mind with Hitler about the demonological nature of the Jews and hence believed in the necessity and justice of the mass murder, or they must have believed that they were committing the greatest crime in history. In my view, the majority of the killers could not be described by either of these polar opposite views. In addition to a multi-layered portrayal of the battalion, I offered a multi-causal explanation of motivation. I noted the importance of conformity, peer pressure, and deference to authority, and I should have emphasized more explicitly the legitimizing capacities of government. I also emphasized the mutually intensifying effects of war and racism, as the years of anti-Semitic propaganda dovetailed with the polarizing effects of war. I argued that nothing helped the Nazis to wage a race war so much as the war itself, as the dichotomy of racially superior Germans and racially inferior Jews, central to Nazi ideology, could easily merge with the image of a beleaguered Germany surrounded by enemies. Ordinary Germans did not have to be of one mind with Hitler's demonological view of the Jews to carry out genocide. A combination of situational factors and ideological overlap that concurred on the enemy status and dehumanization of the victims was sufficient to turn ordinary men into willing executioners. Goldhagen claims that we have no choice but to adopt his own explanation because he has irrefutably and resoundingly disproved the conventional explanations, coercion, obedience, social-psychological observations about human behavior, self-interest, and attenuation or fragmentation of responsibility. Several problems emerge. First, these conventional explanations are not invoked by scholars as sole and sufficient causes of perpetrator behavior, but are usually part of a multi-causal approach, what Goldhagen derides as a laundry list. Thus, they do not have to meet the same high test of allegedly accounting for everything that Goldhagen sets for his own explanation. Second, to claim that one has disproved something irrefutably sets a high test that Goldhagen does not meet. And third, even a comprehensive refutation of the conventional explanations would not necessitate accepting Goldhagen's thesis. Let us look more closely at Goldhagen's alleged refutation of two of the so-called conventional explanations, a German propensity to follow orders, and general attributes of human behavior studied by social psychologists, deference to authority, role adaptation, conformity to peer pressure. Goldhagen abruptly dismisses the notion that a propensity to follow orders and unthinking obedience to authority were prominent elements of German political culture. After all, he notes that Germans battled in the streets of Weimar and were openly disdainful of the Republic. But one incident does not make a country's history or characterize its political culture. To claim that German political culture displayed no tendency to obedience because of opposition to Weimar is no more valid than to claim that anti-Semitism was not a part of German political culture by citing Jewish emancipation in 19th-century Germany, a notion Goldhagen emphatically resists. More important is the historical context of Weimar disobedience. Goldhagen notes that Germans were obedient only to government and authority that they deemed legitimate. This is indeed vital to the issue, for it was precisely the democratic, non-authoritarian character of Weimar that delegitimized it in the eyes of those who disdained and attacked it. It was precisely the Nazis' demolition of democracy and the restoration of an authoritarian political system, emphasizing communal obligations over individual rights, that gave them legitimacy and popularity among significant segments of the German population. Indeed, many historians have argued that Germany's incomplete and half-hearted democratic revolutions in 1848 and 1918 opened the door for successful authoritarian counter-revolution and restoration, and that failed democratization, not anti-Semitism, decisively distinguished Germany's political culture from that of France, England, and the United States. The same kinds of evidence and arguments that Goldhagen cites as proof of the pervasiveness of anti-Semitism inculcating hatred of Jews in Germany can also be found in support of the notion that Germany had a strong tradition of authoritarianism inculcating habits of obedience and anti-democratic attitudes. All the elements that Goldhagen himself cites as decisive for shaping political culture, education, public conversation, law, and institutional reinforcement, were at work inculcating authoritarian values in Germany long before the Nazis also used them to incessantly disseminate anti-Semitism. Moreover, the most outspoken anti-Semites in Germany were also anti-democratic and authoritarian. To deny the importance of authoritarian traditions and values in German political culture, while arguing for the pervasiveness of anti-Semitism, is to insist that the glass is half full while denying that it is half empty. To the extent that Goldhagen's arguments about German political culture and anti-Semitism are valid, they are even more so for German political culture and obedience to authority. Goldhagen claims that the social-psychological interpretation is ahistorical and that its adherents imply that any group of people, regardless of their socialization and their beliefs, could be parachuted into the same circumstances and would act in exactly the same way toward any arbitrarily selected group of victims. This is a serious mischaracterization that confuses the experimental setting with scholars' subsequent application of the insights derived. For example, the point of the Milgram and Zimbardo experiments was to isolate the variables of deference to authority and role adaptation precisely so that the dynamic of these factors in human behavior could be examined and better understood. To have run either of these experiments, pitting Serbs against Bosnian Muslims or Hutus against Tutsis, would have been ludicrous, for the very reason that the historically specific ethnic animosities would have introduced a second powerful variable, totally skewing the results. It was precisely because the experiments were kept ahistorical that the insights from them have validity, and that scholars now know that deference to authority and role adaptation are powerful factors shaping human behavior. For scholars studying motivation in concrete historical situations, in which variables cannot be isolated and historical actors are not themselves fully conscious of the complex interaction of factors that shape their behavior, such insights can, in my opinion, be invaluable for sifting through problematic evidence. Goldhagen has repeatedly claimed that his interpretation alone correctly assumes that the perpetrators believed that the slaughter of Jews was necessary and just, while the conventional explanations suffer from the false assumption that the killers believed that what they were doing was wrong and had to be induced to kill against their will. This both mischaracterizes the position of others and poses the issue as a false dichotomy, employing a social-psychological approach in investigating the historically specific instance of crimes of obedience in Vietnam. Kelman and Hamilton have noted a spectrum of response to authority. Between those who acted out of conviction because they shared the values of the regime and its policies on the one hand, and nominal compilers who acted against their will under supervision but did not obey orders when not being watched, there were other possibilities. Many accepted and internalized the role expectation that soldiers must be tough and obedient and carry out state policies, regardless of the content of specific orders. Soldiers and police can willingly obey orders and implement policy that they do not identify as commensurate with their own personal values, even when not supervised, in the same way that soldiers and police often willingly follow orders and are killed in the line of duty, though they do not want to die. They can commit acts in their capacity of soldiers and police that they would deem wrong if done of their own volition, but which they do not consider wrong if sanctioned by the state. And people can change their values, adopting new ones that do not conflict with their actions, thus becoming killers out of conviction as the killing becomes routine. The relationship between authority, belief, and action is not only complex, but it is also unstable and can change over time. The social-psychological approach does not assume, as Goldhagen claims, that the perpetrator's ideology, moral values, and conception of the victims does not matter. But the approach is certainly not congenial to the simplistic reduction of the perpetrator's ideology, moral values, and conception of the victim to a single factor such as antisemitism. I agree with Goldhagen when he states that crimes of obedience depend upon the existence of a propitious social and political context. But the social and political context invariably introduces a plurality of factors beyond the cognition of the perpetrators and identity of the victims, and it produces a complex and changing spectrum or range of response. In short, Goldhagen has not come even close to accurately explicating and then irrefutably disproving several of the key conventional explanations, neither of which is claimed to be a total explanation in itself. Even if the five conventional explanations noted by Goldhagen had been irrefutably disproved, it is not the case that we are left with no choice but to adopt Goldhagen's own interpretation. The search for understanding the motivations of the Holocaust perpetrators is not confined to a limited set. The scholar's quest is not a multiple-choice exam, or at the very least, there must always be another choice. None of the above. Throughout the controversy, Goldhagen has claimed that his approach has restored a moral dimension missing from the accounts of previous historians. For instance, in his recent reply to his critics in The New Republic, Goldhagen asserts that he has recognized the humanity of the perpetrators. His analysis is predicated upon the recognition that each individual made choices about how to treat Jews, which restores the notion of individual responsibility. On the other hand, he claims that scholars like myself have kept the perpetrators at a comfortable arm's length and treated them as automatons or puppets. These claims by Goldhagen are untenable. First, the social-psychological insights he cavalierly dismisses do not treat individuals as mechanically interchangeable parts, nor do they dismiss cultural and ideological factors. As noted above, Goldhagen's assertion that the psychosociological approach is demonstrably false is based on crude caricature. Second, concerning the humanity of the perpetrators and not keeping them at a comfortable arm's length, it is Goldhagen himself who admonishes other scholars to rid themselves of the notion that Germans in the Third Reich were more or less like us and that their sensibilities had remotely approximated our own. And his claim to treat perpetrators as responsible agents who make choices is difficult to reconcile with his deterministic conclusion. During the Nazi period and even long before, most Germans could no more emerge with cognitive models foreign to their society than they could speak fluent Romanian without ever having been exposed to it. It is my position, in contrast, that psychosociological theories, based upon the assumption of inclinations and propensities common to human nature but not excluding cultural influences, provide important insights into the behavior of the perpetrators. I believe that the perpetrators not only had the capacity to choose, but exercised that choice in various ways that covered the spectrum from enthusiastic participation through dutiful, nominal, or regretful compliance to differing degrees of evasion. Which of our two approaches, I would ask, is predicated upon the humanity and individuality of the perpetrators and allows for a moral dimension in the analysis of their choices? Goldhagen and I agree that Reserve Police Battalion 101 was representative of ordinary Germans and that ordinary Germans, randomly conscripted from all walks of life, became willing executioners. But I do not think that his portrayal of the battalion is representative. He is certainly right that there were numerous enthusiastic killers who sought the opportunity to kill, found gratification in inflicting terrible cruelties, and celebrated their deeds. All too many frightening examples of such behavior can be found in both this book and his. But Goldhagen minimizes or denies other layers of behavior that are important to understanding the dynamics of genocidal killing units and that cast doubt on his assertion that the battalion was uniformly pervaded by pride in and principled approval of the mass murder it perpetrated. His portrayal is skewed because he mistakes the part for the whole. This is a flaw that appears repeatedly throughout the book. For instance, I agree that anti-Semitism was a strong ideological current in 19th century Germany, but I do not accept Goldhagen's assertion that anti-Semitism more or less governed the ideational life of civil society in pre-Nazi Germany. I agree that by 1933, anti-Semitism had become part of the common sense of the German right, without thereby concluding that all German society was of one mind with Hitler about the Jews, and that the centrality of anti-Semitism in the party's worldview, program, and rhetoric mirrored the sentiments of German culture. I agree that anti-Semitism, negative stereotyping, dehumanization, and hatred of the Jews was widespread among the killers of 1942. But I do not agree that this anti-Semitism is primarily to be seen as a pre-existing, pent-up anti-Semitism that Hitler had merely to unleash and unshackle. In short, the fundamental problem is not to explain why ordinary Germans, as members of a people utterly different from us and shaped by a culture that permitted them to think and act in no other way than to want to be genocidal executioners, eagerly killed Jews when the opportunity offered. The fundamental problem is to explain why ordinary men, shaped by a culture that had its own particularities, but was nonetheless within the mainstream of Western, Christian, and Enlightenment traditions, under specific circumstances, willingly carried out the most extreme genocide in human history. Why does it matter which of our portrayals of and conclusions about Reserve Police Battalion 101 are closer to the truth? It would be very comforting if Goldhagen were correct, that very few societies have the long-term cultural cognitive prerequisites to commit genocide, and that regimes can only do so when the population is overwhelmingly of one mind about its priority, justice, and necessity. We would live in a safer world if he were right, but I am not so optimistic. I fear that we live in a world in which war and racism are ubiquitous, in which the powers of government mobilization and legitimization are powerful and increasing, in which a sense of personal responsibility is increasingly attenuated by specialization and bureaucratization, and in which the peer group exerts tremendous pressures on behavior and sets moral norms. In such a world, I fear, modern governments that wish to commit mass murder will seldom fail in their efforts for being unable to induce ordinary men to become their willing executioners.